Welcome to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm your volunteer reader, Neil Kelly. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines from the Valley and the State and USA Today. Our first local news story is titled, Man Accused in Wheelchair Death Case Dies in Phoenix Jail, by Sean Raimundo, Arizona Republic. One of the men accused of tying an amputee to a wheelchair and leaving him to die in extreme heat died this weekend, authorities confirmed. Troy Wright was in police custody at the Lower Buckeye Jail in South Phoenix at the time of his July 4th death, which detectives were investigating, according to the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. The Sheriff's Office could not yet confirm the cause of death, as it was waiting for the results of a medical examiner's report, spokesperson William Jinks said. The 45-year-old was arrested July 2nd on suspicion of kidnapping and murder. That came nearly a week after Phoenix police arrested 41-year-old Hector Corrales in connection with the same charges. Police believe that both men are responsible for the death of 33-year-old Aaron Goodick, a diabetic amputee whose health began to deteriorate while living at Corrales' mother's house in South Phoenix. Corrales and Wright are suspected of binding Goodick to a wheelchair with plastic bags before wheeling him out to the canal near South Mountain on June 25th, police said. There, officers later found Goodick slouched in the wheelchair while the Phoenix Fire Department pronounced him dead, according to arrest records. Wright was scheduled to appear in Maricopa County Superior Court for a preliminary hearing on July 8th, according to court filings. However, his death adds another wrinkle to an already complex backstory that led to the incident. Next is an article titled, What You Need to Land a High-Paying Job at Arizona ICE Facility, by Elena Santa Cruz, Arizona Republic. Months of expected legal delays have not deterred the private security company tasked with readying an ICE detention center in Surprise from hiring. Garda World Federal, which was contracted to renovate and operate ICE's warehouse in Surprise, has not removed job postings on its website despite the Department of Homeland Security agreeing in federal court to halt conversion of the building until it completes an environmental review. A judge still has to sign off on the proposed agreement. A spokesperson for Garda World did not return requests for comment. A spokesperson for DHS would not answer questions about how the pause affects Garda World's federal $313 million one-year contract, which could be extended to 2029. The spokesperson did not identify themselves. The planned ICE facility in Surprise was one of several that DHS made earlier this year in an effort to expand detention space. But the federal government is now abandoning some of its plans for warehouses across the nation. Surprise is still expected to move forward, but the project's halt stems from the Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays' lawsuit to prevent the facility from opening. If the facility off Dissert Road and Sweetwater Avenue does open, it's expected to be a processing center for single adult immigrant detainees who will be held between 3 and 7 days, according to DHS. Most of Garda World Federal's job postings say the company was building a pipeline for the roles, which were expected to begin in late 2026. Pay spans from about $23 to $169 an hour, though some positions are salaried. The company generally requires applicants to be at least 21 years old, have a clean criminal record, and either prove their U.S. citizenship or demonstrate they can legally work in the U.S. Applicants must also have a high school diploma or equivalent. Job postings also say employees may be exposed to toxic or caustic chemicals, various weather conditions, fumes, airborne particles, and loud noise. ICE's building sits across the street from a hazardous chemical facility, Rinchem. The higher-paying jobs may look appealing, but, like any job, there are varying education and experience requirements. Here are more specific qualifications for the top 10 high-paying jobs, according to the company's website. Psychiatrist, $169.50 an hour. Applicants must have a Doctor of Medicine or Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine degree, and a license to practice medicine in Arizona, be legally permitted to prescribe controlled substances, have a current CPR certification, possess an American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology Board certification, and have relevant experience in public health, inpatient psychiatric facilities, or a forensic or correctional setting. Clinical Director, $350,000, about $168.27 an hour. Applicants must have a Doctor of Medicine or Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine degree, a minimum of 6 years post-residency experience providing direct patient care as a board-certified or eligible physician in internal medicine, family medicine, preventive health, or pediatrics, and a minimum of 3 years of experience in clinical supervision and leadership of other medical professionals. Applicants must also have a current license to practice medicine in Arizona, be legally permitted to prescribe controlled substances, and have a current CPR certification. Medical Doctor, $135 an hour. Applicants must have a Doctor of Medicine or Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine degree and a minimum of 6 years post-residency experience, providing direct patient care as a board-certified or eligible physician in internal medicine, family medicine, preventive health, or pediatrics. Applicants must also have a current license to practice medicine in Arizona, be legally permitted to prescribe controlled substances, and have a current CPR certification. Dentist, $125 an hour. Applicants must have a Doctor of Dental Surgery or Doctor of Dental Medicine, at least 3 years of experience in clinical dentistry, and be highly proficient in general dentistry and periodontal therapy. Applicants must also be licensed to practice dentistry in Arizona, be legally permitted to prescribe controlled substances, and have a current CPR certification. Facility Director, $164,000, about $78.85 an hour. Applicants must have a bachelor's degree in appropriate discipline or a minimum of 15 years of experience in military or corrections. The job description said a career development program with work that equates to a bachelor's degree could also satisfy the degree requirement. Applicants must also have at least 5 years of related administrative experience and understand what goes into managing a secure detention facility. Psychiatric Mental Health Nurse Practitioner, $77 an hour. Applicants must have an Arizona Nurse Practitioner license and have 1 year of experience as a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. Applicants must also have a current CPR certification. Pharmacist, $75 an hour. Applicants must have a Doctor of Pharmacy, be licensed as a pharmacist in Arizona, have at least 3 years of experience as a pharmacist, and have a current CPR certification. Clinical Pharmacist, $75 an hour. Applicants must have a Doctor of Pharmacy and a completed postgraduate residency or equivalent clinical practice experience, be licensed as a pharmacist in Arizona, have at least 3 years of experience as a pharmacist, and have a current CPR certification. Nurse Practitioner, $72.25 an hour. Applicants must have an Arizona Nurse Practitioner license, 1 year of experience as a nurse practitioner, and a current CPR certification. Nurse Manager, $67.80 an hour. Applicants must have a Bachelor of Science in Nursing and a registered nurse licensed in Arizona, at least 6 years of professional nursing experience, at least 2 years of supervisory nursing experience, and a current CPR certification. The job posting also says applicants should know government detention healthcare and correctional standards, government policies, correctional nursing principles, emergency nursing, ambulatory care, mental health, chronic disease management, and infection control. People in this position should have leadership skills and know how to manage others. The next article is titled, Phoenix Warns Lawsuit Could Unreasonably Restrict City's Powers, by Karina Vanek, Arizona Republic. A lawsuit filed against Phoenix targeting a common tool used to develop affordable housing would unreasonably restrict municipal property rights, lawyers for the city said in a court filing, asking the judge to dismiss the one of the counts in the lawsuit. The suit, filed by the Goldwater Institute on behalf of Bramley Paulin, a downtown Phoenix property owner, accuses Phoenix of breaking state law when it released a request for proposals for a development that was required to include affordable housing. Paulin has frequently hired the Goldwater Institute to represent him in suits against Phoenix, including others that challenge development incentives. Arizona is one of a few states that prohibits mandatory inclusionary zoning, meaning that generally, a city cannot require affordable housing to be included in a project as a condition of its approval. In the lawsuit, Phoenix is accused of mandatory inclusionary zoning by making affordable housing a requirement in their proposals. However, cities can offer incentives for developers that voluntarily adopt inclusionary zoning. In Phoenix's request at the heart of the lawsuit, the city sought development for city-owned land in Phoenix, in downtown Phoenix, and put the solicitation out to developers seeking a mixed-use development that included affordable housing. The request does not mean the city has violated any prohibition on inclusionary zoning, Mark Stapp, executive director of the Masters of Real Estate Development Program at Arizona State University, said. They aren't acting as a regulatory body, he said. Cities are allowed to buy, sell, own, and lease real property. Stapp said the requirement for affordable housing to be included in a proposal functions as a deed restriction, which is an agreed-upon limit on how land can be used after a sale. Deed restrictions are legal in Arizona. The development agreement that was approved by Phoenix included a 40-year deed restriction that limited the primary use of the property to affordable housing, according to Phoenix's motion filed with the court. The suit, filed in Maricopa County Superior Court, is the first of its kind in Arizona, challenging cities' abilities to require affordable housing in their requests, Tony Napolitano, senior attorney for the Goldwater Institute, said in June. Cities frequently sell or lease property for specific purposes, like parks, schools, and other uses, Scott Anderson and Richard Carpenter, attorneys representing Phoenix, said in the city's filing. The Goldwater Institute's interpretation of the issue would hamstring Arizona municipalities' ability to sell property for the furtherance of the public's interest, including affordable housing, they said in the motion to dismiss the count alleging illegal inclusionary zoning. The suit focuses on one development planned in Phoenix, but could eliminate cities' abilities to use city-owned land for affordable housing if they are no longer able to require it in the proposals they solicit. The development at the heart of the suit is a proposal by Penrose, an affordable housing developer, that responded to a city-issued request for proposals seeking a development that included affordable housing along with a mix of uses. Penrose was deemed the successful respondent to the request, and the city entered into an agreement to sell the site to the developer for $1.5 million, which was later amended to $1.6 million. In exchange, Penrose promised a five-story, 64-unit affordable housing development. The project is supposed to be income-restricted, renting to people earning 60% of the area median income or below. The suit also alleges the sale violated the state's gift clause, which prevents Arizona governments from transactions that do not provide equivalent public benefit. In this case, the suit alleges that the land was appraised for about $4.8 million, meaning it was sold for about $3.2 million less than its appraised value. The city's motion did not address the gift clause allegation. Next is an article titled, What's Being Built at the Scottsdale Culinary Institute Site by Sean Raimundo, Arizona Republic. Location, 8102 East Campbellback Road on the northeast corner of Hayden Road in South Scottsdale. Description, a long-planned senior living community near Old Town Scottsdale is under construction and nearly ready for residents. The developer, Spectrum Retirement Communities, is building the large 111-bed complex called the Pavilion at Campbellback, which will feature both assisted living and memory care services. It'll comprise a two- and three-story building on a nearly five-acre site next to Campbellback Park, replacing the long-shuttered Scottsdale Culinary Institute. The new building's layout will include an interior courtyard that residents can access from the internal dining and common areas. Residents there will have access to daily activities, scheduled transportation, and dining experiences, according to Spectrum. The company also boasted that Pavilion will feature several amenities, including a beauty salon and barber, a bistro, a demonstration kitchen, a wellness center, a library, resident lounges, and a theater. History. The site was previously home to Le Cordon Bleu Culinary Institute of Scottsdale, also known as the Scottsdale Culinary Institute. After teaching aspiring chefs for three decades, the school, which was the largest of its kind in the area, closed in June 2017. Soon after, the school's two-story building was demolished, paving the path for Spectrum's project. Scottsdale's Development Review Board approved the project in October 2019. When will work be done? Spectrum expects to welcome residents to Pavilion in spring 2027. Next is an article titled, El Mirage Man Dies After Taser Use During Domestic Violence Call, by Robert Anglin, Arizona Republic. A July 4th domestic violence 911 call ended with the death of a man in El Mirage police custody. Peter Patton Jr., 35, died after officers shocked him with taser stun guns, according to a statement posted on the department's Facebook page. Police described Patton as the aggressor, identified in emergency calls. His actions and behavior near the two victims led officers to immediately act by deploying their issued tasers to take control of Mr. Patton and remove him from the residence, the department said in its July 7th statement. There is no indication in the statement how many officers shocked Patton, how many times he was hit, or the duration of the electrical charges. Police officials could not immediately be reached for comment. After the taser deployment, officers gained control of Mr. Patton, handcuffed him, and removed him from the residence, the statement said. The El Mirage Fire Department was called to respond following the taser deployment to check Mr. Payton's welfare as part of our normal protocol. Payton's erratic behavior continued after he was handcuffed when he began kicking at officers, according to the statement. About an hour after the 911 call, Payton died at a hospital just before 8 p.m., police said. Shortly after fire personnel arrived, Mr. Payton lost consciousness, the department's statement said. Despite life-saving efforts by fire and hospital personnel, the subject was pronounced deceased. The Peoria Police Department was investigating Payton's death as part of the West Valley Incident Response Team, a task force made up of officers from 9 departments that handles critical cases involving officers. The identities of the 2 other people involved in the incident were not immediately known, nor was it clear if they received any injuries. The next article is titled, Phoenix is under an extreme heat warning, but when will it rain? By Tevian Whitehurst, Arizona Republic. Real summer in Metro Phoenix and the Greater Valley is finally kicking in as we face what could be the first 115-degree day of the year. The week started off warm with Monday, July 6th, reaching 113 degrees, and temperatures are expected to remain in the triple-digit teens for the rest of the week. Much of the southern half of Arizona is under extreme heat warnings beginning Tuesday, July 7th. In central and southwest Arizona, those warnings last until Thursday, July 9th. In southeast Arizona, around Tucson, warnings last until Wednesday evening, July 8th. Monsoonal moisture is a second focus in the corner of the state, while temperatures push to 111 degrees in lower elevations around Tucson, including in Pima, Pinal, Graham, and Greeline counties. To the north, temperatures are expected to exceed 100 degrees in locations below 5,000 feet elevation. Heat risk will range from moderate to extreme through the rest of the work week, with the biggest danger the lack of cool down during the night. Overnight lows are expected to sit in the upper 80s and 90s throughout the region, offering little to no relief for those who are vulnerable. Wednesday is expected to be the worst, with widespread major heat risk in the Phoenix and Tucson areas, and additional spots of extreme risk. The Arizona Department of Health Services has posted a map of cooling centers, hydration stations, and other resources for those who need them. High pressure is expected to park over Arizona midweek, making Wednesday in particular the hottest day before that higher pressure continues west, out to the Pacific, loosening its grip on the state by the weekend. How quickly that shift occurs will impact whether a heat warning is issued for Friday, July 10th, as well. That same high will continue to bob around the region, which would give the valley a good opportunity for monsoon storms during the weekend or early next week, but the timing isn't quite solidified. Phoenix's opportunity for rain hasn't quite hit yet. Increasing humidity from dew point temperatures in the 40s and 50s will add some extra oomph to the heat's effect, but actual rainfall chances will take longer to spread. Showers and storms began in the southeast and higher elevations on Monday, July 6th. At the start of the week, activity remains far to the east, closer to the Arizona-New Mexico border, along the Mongolian Rim and White Mountains. Storm chances shift farther west with each day following. The Tucson area could see storms as soon as Tuesday, July 7th. At first, the main threats will be wind and blowing dust throughout about Wednesday, but as deeper moisture moves in late week, flash flooding will also be a threat. More centrally, some outflows could make it to the East Valley. But again, that greater opportunity for activity doesn't come until later in the forecast. Our next local news article is titled, "This Arizona Town is Getting Its First In-N-Out Burger. What to Know?" by Eddie Fontanez, Arizona Republic. In-N-Out Burger is expanding, with 6 new locations planned in 5 different states. One of the planned openings includes the chain's first location in the town of Santan Valley. The Santan Valley location is currently listed as opening soon on In-N-Out's website. The company has begun accepting online applications to work at the new restaurant. The Arizona Republic reached out to In-N-Out Burger to inquire about an opening date, but did not hear back at the time of writing. In-N-Out Burger currently has 40 other locations in the state of Arizona. An opening date has not yet been set for In-N-Out Burger's upcoming Santan Valley location. Details: 33375 North Gary Road, Santan Valley, 1-800-786-1000, inandout.com. The next article is titled, "Teens Joyride Knocks Out Power to Buckeye Neighborhood, Police Say," by Sean Raimundo, Arizona Republic. A teen's early morning joyride ended with his arrest after he plowed into an electrical box that cut power to a Buckeye neighborhood, authorities said. The 15-year-old boy, whose name will not be released because he's a minor, reportedly stole his brother's Jeep so he and 2 friends could go for a drive, the Buckeye Police Department said. Shortly after 3 a.m., July 6th, the teen lost control of the vehicle and crashed into the electrical box, narrowly missing a house near Antelope Trail and 239th Avenue, police said in a video posted on the department's social media channels. The collision caused a power outage, prompting APS utility crews to restore power, according to police. It's unclear how long the neighborhood was without power. Following the incident, the teen and his 2 friends were believed to have fled the crash scene, Officer Carissa Planalp, a department spokesperson, stated in an email. She wasn't immediately available to explain how the 15-year-old was later caught. Buckeye police arrested him on suspicion of reckless driving, hit and run, criminal damage, and unlawful use of a vehicle, according to the social media post. One of the passengers suffered minor injuries, Planalp said. Next is an article titled, "Why Quick Approval of Arizona Mine Concerns Jaguar Advocates," by Sarah Henry, Arizona Republic. The U.S. Forest Service has approved a fast-tracked critical minerals mine in southern Arizona despite years of pushback from nearby communities. The $2 billion South 32 Hermosa project will unearth deposits of zinc, manganese, lead, and silver, all deemed critical minerals and buried in the Patagonia Mountains near the U.S.-Mexico border. The underground mine will sit mostly on private land but stretch into the Coronado National Forest, where a waste tailings pile and other infrastructure will be built on federally designated endangered jaguar habitat. South 32 is one of the first projects to work its way through an expedited approvals process expanded by both the Biden and Trump administrations. Under former President Joe Biden, the mine was listed under the Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act of 2015, dubbed FAST 41. It's meant to accelerate the permitting process and improve transparency for projects that could benefit the county. Both zinc and manganese are considered critical minerals needed for batteries, defense, and construction. President Trump has launched an all-of-government mandate to strengthen and secure America's critical minerals supplies chains, said U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Brooke L. Rollins in a July 7th press release praising the Hermosa project. It's among 56 mining projects in the FAST 41 program, which has garnered criticism from conservationists. Community members in Santa Cruz County say the rush to approve the mine has left fundamental questions about long-term environmental impacts unanswered and will put one of the most biodiverse regions of the state in peril. Already, discharged water from the mine has been flagged by the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality for exceeding allowable levels of heavy metals. This sets a troubling precedent that weakens long-standing environmental protections for public lands, said Anna Darian, the executive director of Patagonia Area Resource Alliance, in an email to the Arizona Republic. The South 32 Hermosa Mine is located in the Patagonia Mountains, a 15-mile range in the Madrean Sky Islands, which connect the Sierra Madres in Mexico to the Rocky Mountains. The Sky Islands are isolated high-elevation mountain ranges with unique ecosystems separated by the arid desert below them. They are also one of the most biodiverse regions in the world and an important wildlife corridor. Conservationists say the Forest Service's approval is putting the Patagonias in jeopardy. The Forest Service failed to adequately analyze the project's impacts on wildlife and habitat connectivity in one of the Southwest's most ecologically significant landscapes, Darian said. With new roads, a tailings pile, transmission lines, and other infrastructure, the mine could fragment portions of critical habitat for threatened species like jaguars and Mexican spotted owls. The Forest Service amended the Coronado National Forest Plan, granting 31 exceptions to previously enshrined stipulations in order to accommodate mine. Those expectations and the expedited approval mean that the agency approved the project prematurely and without addressing all potential impacts to wildlife and water, conservationists say. Bulldozing new roads and building a tailings dump site on federally protected habitat for jaguars and Mexican spotted owls will push these endangered animals closer to extinction, said Russ McSpad, a Southwest conservationist advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity, in a press release. As approved, the mine will have a 70-year lifespan. Each year, it's expected to remove 2,790 acre-feet of water from the aquifer, amounting to 195,000 acre-feet over the course of its operation. Though some water will be recharged, the final environmental impact statement notes that net water loss from the aquifer will be 34,000 acre-feet, equivalent to over 1 billion gallons. Nearby residents in the project's 50-mile cone of depression worry that groundwater pumping could cause their wells to run dry and that the overall dewatering could affect the surrounding ecosystem, both possibilities listed in the environmental impact statement. Groundwater management wells and dewatering practices could affect groundwater-dependent special status species and habitat that occurs in the project's groundwater drawdown cone, the statement reads. Groundwater levels would decline to varied extents in private wells within the dewatering radius of influence. Instead of evaluating the impacts collectively, the agency reviewed them in isolation, Darian said. As a result, the environmental review understated or deferred analysis of groundwater depletion, wastewater discharges, air quality, wildlife habitat, public health, and cumulative impacts. A decade ago, President Barack Obama created the Fast 41 program to streamline permitting for infrastructure projects. Under Biden, it was expanded to include critical minerals. South 32 was the first mining project covered by Fast 41, said Emily Domenech, the executive director of the federal government's permitting council, in a statement. It helped lay the groundwork for the additional mining projects that have followed during the Trump administration, she said. Since taking office again, President Donald Trump has added 54 more mining projects and a host of minerals to the critical minerals list, an expansion that's raised alarms among environmentalists and lawmakers who worry that Fast 41 is being exploited to quickly approve projects with potentially large and lasting environmental footprints. In an April letter to Forest Service Chief Tom Schultz, Arizona Representative Adelita Grijalva, a Democrat, wrote that the Hermosa project's designation as the first critical minerals project under the Fast 41 permitting framework makes it especially consequential. She stressed that while Fast 41 is meant to improve efficiency in permitting, mining is one of the most environmentally impactful stud industries, and as a result, expedited permitting shouldn't come at the expense of public participation. In a statement, South 32 said Hermosa's advancement under Fast 41 did not reduce the robustness of environmental review or limit public input. But Darien and 14 other Arizona environmental organizations say that none of their concerns were meaningfully addressed in the Forest Service's final decision. You are listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Neil Kelly, and we'll continue with the news. Next is an article titled, 145 Arizonans Apprehended in July 4th Chaos in Newport Beach, by Michelle Cruz and Paris Bazara, Arizona Republic. A large number of Arizonans took part in a chaotic 4th of July celebration that reportedly devolved into blocking roadways and throwing fireworks at police in a California beach city. The city of Newport Beach said police arrested 402 people from midnight on July 3rd through 6 a.m. on July 5th, including people who refused dispersal orders. The city's police declared an unlawful assembly, citing large unruly crowds near 26th Street and the beach just before 8:30 p.m. on July 4th. Nearly half of the people who were apprehended during the incident were from Arizona. The Orange County Register reported on July 7th, citing data from police. Of those arrested or cited during the July 4th chaos, 161 were from California and 145 were from Arizona, the newspaper reported. The data showed 11 Arizonans were arrested and 134 were cited. According to the city, 4th of July celebrations drew tens of thousands of residents and visitors. However, social media posts drew a large influx of juveniles and young adults to the Newport Pier area within a short period of time, the city said in a news release. As the crowd rapidly grew, individuals engaged in increasingly dangerous and unlawful behavior, including by blocking roadways, restricting emergency vehicle access, and throwing explosive mortars, fireworks, and other projectiles at police officers, the city said. Joe DeJulio, president of the Newport Beach Police Association, posted a statement online praising officers who acted with courage, professionalism, and excellence. Yesterday, as our nation celebrated its semi-quincentennial with families and neighbors gathering peacefully, joyfully, and safely, a large group of agitators invaded Newport Beach, spurred on by an alleged TikTok takeover. These persons came to our city with the intent of causing harm, injury, and destruction, bringing harassment, disturbances, and mayhem, DeJulio said. Our next article is titled, Arizona Eases School Voucher Reimbursement Rule After Lawsuit, by Alexandra Hartle and Stacey Barchinger, Arizona Republic. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays has agreed to roll back a school voucher oversight requirement her office previously defended, settling a lawsuit that makes it easier for families to obtain reimbursement for supplies through the state's Empowerment Scholarship Account program. The agreement was reached to avoid the lengthy process of going to trial after conservative think tank Goldwater Institute in 2024 filed a lawsuit against the state of Arizona, Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn, and the Arizona Department of Education. Mays has been a prominent critic of Horn's handling of the school voucher program, repeatedly saying it needs more guardrails. The lawsuit was filed over a policy that required parents utilizing the program to tie any supplemental materials, including books, pencils, and calculators, to a curriculum. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of two Arizona women utilizing the Empowerment Scholarship Account program. Parents needed to upload curriculum documents proving the materials were needed in order to get reimbursed. But the settlement with Mays, which was agreed upon by attorneys from all parties, reverses that policy, saying supplemental materials need not be listed as required or recommended on a curriculum document in order to be approved. Instead of having to upload curriculum documents, parents will only need to select a subject area from a drop-down menu, which will include options such as history, math, and art. Parents will also need to attest that the purchases will be used for educational purposes. If those steps are not followed, the Arizona Department of Education will not reimburse the program, the purchase, according to the settlement. The policy will go into effect as soon as ClassWallet, the program's financial management platform, is able to implement it. In 2024, the Arizona Department of Education began halting certain school voucher purchases when the Arizona Attorney General's office announced it was investigating the allegations that the department had authorized illegal expenses under the program. According to the Attorney General's office at the time, state law required supplemental materials to relate to a curriculum, while the handbook did not require families to prove such a connection. After that, the department changed course and stopped allowing families enrolled in the program to purchase supplemental materials and textbooks without first identifying a curriculum that justifies those purchases. According to the complaint, the requirement was in violation of the Empowerment Scholarship Account Handbook and was thus forcing the department to violate its own policies. At the time, Horn said he hoped his office would lose the case and that he would testify in support of the Goldwater Institute if necessary. John Riches, vice president of litigation at the Goldwater Institute, said the think tank got involved because neither the law nor the handbook required the curriculum documents, and it's a tedious process for parents to upload documents for every eraser purchased, he said. Under the agreement, the Attorney General's office will no longer require the Arizona Department of Education to ask parents for curriculum documents when it comes to reimbursements for supplemental materials. The handbook is really clear that documentation is not required for these items, so we were glad to see the state agree that curriculum documentation isn't required for these, Riches said. Riches said the policy will only impact what is identified as supplemental material in the ESA handbook, which includes items like writing utensils, books, and rulers. The change in policy will not impact the process outside of the items identified as supplemental materials in the parent handbook. Horn said the new requirement will lessen the burden on parents when it comes to submitting their purchases for reimbursement. But Horn emphasized the need for additional employees within the Department of Education to combat the unauthorized purchases made through the program. Per the settlement, any reimbursements made could still be subject to further investigation. Nothing in this agreement limits the department's authority to review and request additional information regarding supplemental material expenditures in the ESA program, including situations in which the ADE has a reasonable basis to believe that expenditures are improper or do not meet the particular circumstances or educational needs of the ESA recipient, the settlement said. Mays has been a vocal critic of the program, getting into numerous public spats with Horn. In December, Mays threatened to sue Horn over his handling of the program, in particular, a policy that allows the automatic reimbursement of any purchases of $2,000 or less. Mays, in an interview with the Arizona Republic, acknowledged the requirements of the settlement would not go far enough to combat misspending in the voucher program. We got them to a point where they were willing to acknowledge at least the need for parents to verify that they are using the funds for a legitimate purpose. It's a self-attestation, Mays said. But obviously that's not going to be good enough over the long haul. I'll be the first person to say that. We need real, rigorous reforms of the ESA program. Mays, a Democrat seeking a second term this year, who was unopposed in the July primary, led a roundtable event favoring Empowerment Scholarship Account reform in South Phoenix on July 6th. Mays said she agreed to settle Goldwater's lawsuit because it was obvious the think tank would not agree to extensive reforms on supplemental materials. To settle was to spend taxpayer dollars wisely, she said. Problems persist, she said, pointing to recent regular reporting revealing voucher families are spending taxpayer dollars on diamond rings, flat-screen TVs, and trips to Disneyland, none of which have a justifiably associated curriculum, she said. It is just absurd for the Goldwater Institute to claim victory, she said. Victory over what? Are they beating their chest that they think it's okay for fraud, waste, and abuse to exist in this program? Our next article is titled, Catholic Converts Surge in Phoenix. What's Behind the Enormous Shift? By Jose R. Gonzalez, Arizona Republic. Candles danced and hymns rang out this spring as an estimated 1,600 adults establishing their new spiritual home in the Catholic Church gathered for Lenten season liturgies known as the Rite of Election. So many converts had spent months preparing for the sacraments that would bring them into full church participation that the Roman Catholic Diocese of Phoenix had to split the event into multiple services in 2026 and also in 2025. Beneath the wings of the solemn occasion, which spread across four churches throughout the Metro Phoenix, was a wave of emotion that struck Bishop John Dolan. Real joy in their heart, Dolan said, of seeing the soon-to-be converts. They're just so excited. What's happening in Metro Phoenix is what is being reported by Catholic dioceses nationwide. The church is welcoming new adult members at higher rates. This phenomenon is one reason the Phoenix Diocese has grown to be the country's second biggest in population. Metro Phoenix residents, all under 40 years old, spoke with the Arizona Republic about their recent path to Catholicism. Nearly all referenced the Catholic Church's deep history. All expressed how Catholicism strengthened their Christian faith, whether newfound or long-held. Something holy is taking place, something historical, something that goes way back, and they're intrigued by that, said Joyce Coronel, the Phoenix Diocese manager over evangelization and sacramental life. She described the current scale of interest to come to the church as enormous. Coronel starts her workday early, anticipating she will talk to people searching for religious fulfillment. There is no shortage. She said her office is inundated with phone calls and emails asking about the church. The hundreds at this year's rite of election services made for some of the highest turnouts in the country, according to the diocese. Those who want to join participate in several months of study before they are baptized, if they haven't been already, and receive confirmation and the Eucharist and Easter Vigil services at their parish churches. The celebration of these sacraments concludes the new convert's spiritual preparation under what is called the Order of Christian Initiation of Adults. Most of the younger converts, according to Coronel, 62, express a longing for authenticity. I don't want to just go to a concert or a pep talk. Like, I want something holy, Coronel said a recent convert in his 20s told her. When you walk into a Catholic church and you walk into a mass, you encounter something otherworldly. The Phoenix Diocese has, in recent years, swelled to 2.01 million parishioners, according to internal data. This makes the Phoenix Diocese second in the U.S. only to the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, according to the 2025 edition of the Official Catholic Directory, which is published by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. In 2024, the Phoenix Diocese ranked 7th. The growth has prompted internal discussions about establishing as many as 4 more parishes and building new churches in the future, Brett Meister, the Diocese Communications Director, said on July 6th, only days before the diocese announced the addition of a parish in Laveen. The Phoenix Diocese provided the Republic with recent convert figures. The Republic measured the differences between 2022, the first full year after COVID-19 mask mandates were loosened in Arizona, and 2025, the most recent year with full data. The diocese had 512 adult baptisms in 2025, according to the data. This reflected a 46.7% jump from 2022, an 84.8% spike from 2023, and a 24% bump from 2024. Adult baptisms have increased significantly over the past 3 years, and we anticipate this number will also be higher as the solid data from 2026 comes in, Meister said. The diocese saw 1,404 confirmations and 1,118 First Communions in 2025 for adults, compared with 507 confirmations and 621 First Communions in 2022, according to data provided. Of 71 Catholic dioceses in the U.S., that responded to queries by the National Catholic Register, all but 5 expected a rise in converts, some significantly ahead of Easter Sunday 2026, the publication reported. A national survey conducted February 22nd to May 31st by the Archdiocese of Chicago found specific reasons for conversion. The 2,127 respondents, including some in Phoenix and Peoria, were in the process of converting. A major motive was personal hunger, as in pursuing goodness, truth, and inner peace. Another leading aim for conversion was institutional church, citing the liturgy or the wisdom of the 2,000-year-old body. The majority of respondents, 69%, were Gen Zers and millennials. Most respondents, 64%, identified as white, non-Hispanic. 5 new Catholics within the Phoenix Diocese shared how they were called to the church. Brittany and Gavin Stinson of Gilbert met and fell in love while in college. Before they exchanged vows in September, they sought what Gavin Stinson, 29, said was a solid foundation. The pair grew up Christian, he in a non-denominational upbringing in Arizona, and she within the Lutheran Church in Minnesota. After reading the Bible front to back together, the couple felt the Roman Catholic Church best sated their religious curiosity and certainty. I think where we were trying to get answers and piece together everything, there was never an actual answer. It felt like it was just kind of like, well, it could be this. Brittany Stinson, 27, said of other religious doctrine teachings, Catholicism is like, no, this is the answer, and this is why. Here's some different readings to back it up. For Riley Myers, 23, her spiritual awakening came about sometime after she returned in August 2024 to her home in Avondale. She had been away during a period that included what she described as a fruitless year at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. I was trying to find out who I was, and felt like I wasn't going anywhere, and I was just really sick and tired of it, and so I prayed to God and begged for him to help, Myers said. I decided I want to go back to church. Myers' stepfather had taken her as a 14-year-old to St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Avondale. Considering the church, located on Thomas Road near Litchfield Road, was the nearest to her home, she drove there for Mass in early 2025. She was swept away by the stillness of the church and the reverence she witnessed among the congregants. I understood it on a level I couldn't when I was younger, she said. It was just this warmth and this presence. And she was in awe of the embodiment of the faith in the detailed body of Christ on the cross hanging above the church's altar. Similarly, Austin Ennenbach had been on a spiritual journey when in early 2025 he found Catholicism on campus as a student at Grand Canyon University. Ennenbach had gone to Protestant services but said he had never been moved as he was during a worship at Holy Spirit Newman Center, a small Catholic church for GCU students on the corner of Camelback Road and 31st Avenue in Phoenix. The 23-year-old Litchfield Park resident said he was struck by the veneration of those gathered who were on their knees and how the sacraments were upheld in the holy space. In the Catholic Church, there's so much beauty, there's so much architecture, and everything you look at points you to Jesus, Ennenbach said. Scott Johnson grew up in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but stopped attending services at 12. As an adult in 2024, he lost a friend and a family member to suicide 2 months apart, was laid off, and his home suffered a flooding. His YouTube algorithm started suggesting videos on biblical archaeology, an interest that had never waned for the 38-year-old Glendale resident. Around the same time, another friend began discussing Catholicism with Johnson, who was then compelled to convert. The emphasis on history in the conversion classes appealed to him, along with the antiquity of the church, whose faith tradition lists the Apostle Peter as the first pontiff, he said. Aside from however comforted he was by the church in a time of personal struggle, Johnson said he converted because my heart was open. I heard him knocking. I answered the door. The church has been undergoing a transformation in the past 13 years. Pope Leo XIV and his predecessor, Pope Francis, were the first two pontiffs born in the Americas. Leo, like Francis before him, has pushed for the inclusion of marginalized groups and pushed for social justice. We're seeing the church moving more out of the whole theology books and more into the streets and into the care of people, Dolan said. And the converts the Republic spoke with have immersed themselves in the church's ministries of outreach. The Stinsons are a part of their parish's conference at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, where they regularly volunteer in food drives. Gavin Stinson and Johnson are members of the Catholic Fraternal Order of the Knights of Columbus, where they carry out charitable deeds. Dolan, 63, said younger generations are more emboldened to pursue what they feel has been missing after 50 to 60 years of decline in religious participation in the U.S. Social media, he suggested, also appears to be more immediately explained Catholicism to the masses, particularly to Gen Z users. Dolan said it's okay not to have a concrete answer for the boost in converts. He is leaving the timing and reasons behind the growth to the unknown workings of the divine. After all, the Roman Catholic Church is full of mysteries of the faith. Why did God come to us 2,000 years ago instead of 500 years ago or even 100 years ago in the person of Jesus? Dolan said, the Holy Spirit moves as he wills. We move now to USA Today, and the first article there is titled, Judge Orders Trump's $5.8 Million Be Paid to E. Jean Carroll for Judgment, by Bart Janssen, USA Today. A federal judge ordered July 8th that New York columnist E. Jean Carroll be paid $5.8 million from a judgment against President Donald Trump, but he immediately appealed the ruling. Trump contends that he still has appeals that could protect him from that case and another $83 million judgment that Carroll won against him. U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan ordered that the money from the first case, $5 million plus interest, that has accumulated in a court investment account, be paid to Carroll despite Trump's opposition. Trump appealed that decision to the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Trump argues that both cases are intertwined and rely on official presidential statements. The Supreme Court ruled in 2024 that presidents are immune from prosecution for most official acts, which Trump contends should protect him from Carroll's lawsuits, too. Trump's formal response is the latest wrinkle in Carroll's attempt to punish him for a disputed episode from the 1990s, when she alleged that Trump sexually assaulted her at a New York City department store. The smaller judgment resulted from a New York jury finding Trump liable for sexual abuse against Carroll. The larger judgment resulted from a separate jury finding Trump defamed Carroll when he denied her allegations. Kaplan told the second jury to accept the previous jury's judgment and decide only how much Trump owed Carroll for comments he made as president. The Supreme Court declined to hear his appeal of the $5.8 million case June 29th. Carroll then asked Kaplan to order Trump to pay her. But in Trump's reply July 7th, he said he could still appeal the $83 million judgment by July 28th. He's also asked the Supreme Court for a rehearing in the $5.8 million case, which was the one the justices just rejected. Trump contends that his statements as president were key to the smaller judgment and were an indispensable part of the larger judgment. That use of official presidential statements matters because this court has made clear that official presidential acts may not be used as evidence to impose liability for other conduct, Trump lawyers said in a court filing. Before Kaplan's latest ruling, Trump said if the judge orders him to pay Carroll, he is likely to never recover the funds. He cited several articles where she was quoted as saying she would spend the money on something Trump hates. The next article from USA Today is titled, Iran Live Updates, Trump's Not Sure He Still Wants a Deal with Iran, by Francesca Chambers, Aaron Mansfield, Rachel Barber, Bart Janssen, and Joey Garrison, USA Today. President Donald Trump said he's no longer sure he wants to negotiate a peace deal with Iran, as he called Tehran's leaders sick people, and signaled he would rather end the conflict militarily, casting major doubt on whether the U.S. ceasefire with Iran will hold. I'm not sure I want to make a deal, Trump said at a July 8th news conference at the NATO summit in Turkey. Let's just finish the job. Trump's remarks came as he threatened a second night of airstrikes on Iran after the two sides traded strikes following a series of attacks on tankers in the Strait of Hormuz that the U.S. blamed on Iran. To me, I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them, Trump said earlier in the day on the status of a preliminary agreement reached in June. That agreement established a 60-day ceasefire and reopened the Strait of Hormuz, while talks on a long-term deal addressing Iran's nuclear capability were to continue. Asked whether he's restarting the U.S. war on Iran, Trump pushed back. I don't think it's going to start again, he said. Anything that happens is going to be over very quickly. Trump made the threats several hours after Iran said it targeted U.S. military sites in Bahrain and Kuwait in response to renewed U.S. airstrikes on Iran. The U.S. was retaliating to attacks on commercial ships in the Strait of Hormuz that the American officials described as a ceasefire violation. They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people, and they're vicious, violent people, Trump said. As far as I'm concerned, it's just a waste of time dealing with them. They're liars. Follow along with USA Today for live updates. When Trump signed a memorandum of understanding with Iran in June, the president called Iranian leaders very rational, strong, smart, and nice to deal with. But as a preliminary peace deal appeared on the verge of crumbling, Trump had very different descriptions. They're scum, they're sick people, they're led by sick people, and they're vicious, violent people. So, what changed? I got to know them, Trump said when a reporter asked this question, though he added that the current leaders in Iran are more rational than previous leaders who were killed during the war. Level 1 is gone. Level 2 is gone. This is level 3. I think they are more rational, but based on their actions over the last week or two, they're not doing a service to the people. Our next USA Today article is titled, "Why is Everyone Saying They Talked to Mitch McConnell for 20 Minutes?" by Melina Kahn, USA Today. Senator Mitch McConnell's recent conversations with colleagues are drawing attention as he remains hospitalized for an undisclosed reason. As questions about McConnell's health continued to mount, two of his colleagues and a longtime confidant revealed that they recently spoke to the 84-year-old from the hospital. Both Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, and Senate Majority Whip John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming, spoke to McConnell on July 6th and 7th, respectively, aides confirmed. Scott Jennings, a commentator and longtime McConnell advisor, also said he spoke to the senator on July 7th. McConnell's office has shared little about his hospitalization beyond revealing he was admitted on June 14th and saying as recently as July 7th that he continues to improve. Now, the internet is fixating on McConnell's reported conversations and the mystery surrounding his hospitalization, with social media users riffing that they too talked to the senator about dramatized topics. On July 6th, Thune spoke with McConnell on a variety of topics, including national security, and the conversation was long and substantive, a Thune spokesperson said in a statement. The following day, Barrasso talked to McConnell for roughly 20 minutes, discussing topics like upcoming Senate work, the latest Supreme Court news, and the main Senate race, according to a statement from Barrasso spokesperson Kate Noyes. Senator McConnell was fully engaged and is eager to get back to the Senate, Noyes said. Also on July 7th, Jennings said in a post on X that he spoke with McConnell, who he said is still recovering in the hospital. We talked for just shy of 20 minutes about Iran, Ukraine, and the unfolding situation in Maine, my visit to the TR Presidential Library, and even a little bit of Senate history. I told him we want to see him back at work as soon as possible, Jennings wrote. And that is all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Neil Kelly. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.